This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we'll be taking a tour of the country and talking about some of the best science and technology-related tourist destinations. And we're looking for your advice. If you got a tip for us, where a place that we should not miss, well, you can email your tip to travel@sciencefriday.com. And we'll put them up on our website and also try to talk about them on the air. But first, a tour that is a bit, just a bit, more focused. What kind of vacation would you take if you were interested in history, technology, and nuclear weapons? If you're a journalist who writes about defense and one happens to be married to another defense reporter, how about a nuclear family vacation? Sharon Weinberger is just such a person, and she did take that tour, visiting some of the world's most famous atomic sites, from Los Alamos to Iran, and she wrote about it. She's a contributing writer for Wired's Danger Room blog and co-author with her husband, Nathan Hodge, of the book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. And she joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Happy 4th of July to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good day for you to talk about the nuclear family vacation.
It's vacation time of year, certainly.
Well, now, what came over you? Are you that much interested in the history of nuclear weapons? You just set out across the world to look at these famous sites?
You know, originally it wasn't so much nuclear weapons that drew us to it. About three years ago, we were trying to figure out, some sort of vacation to take over the summer. And, you know, we wanted to do perhaps some work on the side. And we kind of half jokingly came up with this idea of nuclear vacationing, because there is a sort of rise in nuclear tourism. And, you know, we had an aunt in Las Vegas, not far from the Nevada test site. Mm-hmm. We had a cousin at Los Alamos, a brother in California by a nuclear lab. So we kind of came up with this itinerary.
So you could visit the folks and see the sites at the same time.
Exactly. And there is sort of this, influx of people wanting to visit some of these former and sometimes current nuclear sites. And we thought we'd check out what they were seeing.
Tell us about it. It's a really interesting site in Sandia and Livermore. It seemed like there were some really interesting things to see there.
Well, basically, you have the three nuclear weapons laboratories. You have Sandia and Los Alamos in New Mexico, and you have Lawrence Livermore in Northern California. And so that was part of our original itinerary, along with the Nevada test site and the Trinity site in New Mexico, where the first atomic bomb was detonated. And so you still have these three nuclear weapons laboratories that both, they have public tours, and then they're also, of course, they're nuclear weapons laboratories. They work right now on maintaining our nuclear deterrent. They're involved in homeland security, in nonproliferation. And sort of the irony of that is, on the flip side, they need public support, so you can go on tours of some of these still active places.
And you can see models of nuclear bombs there?
Some of them have bombs. Some of them, they all have museums associated with them. We wanted to do a little bit of both, in that we visited some of the museums. For instance, there's a new, relatively new, a couple years old atomic museum in Las Vegas, which is just a wonderful museum. But on the flip side of that, we also wanted to speak to people who are still active in these sites and laboratories. We wanted to speak to a nuclear weapons designer. I mean, we had the question of, well, we don't design new nuclear weapons right now in the United States, so what does a nuclear weapons designer do? And kind of we found this sort of almost schizophrenic thing where you have these museums and tours dedicated to promoting our laboratories and infrastructure. And yet at the same time, the people who work within these places feel, in a lot of cases, very lost about what their purpose is in a world where you don't have mutually assured destruction. And they're sort of groping for a purpose.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Sharon Weinberger, co-author of A Nuclear Family Vacation. And it's interesting, you mentioned in your book one person who used to be, let's call him a hippie of the 60s, who actually protested against nuclear weaponry. Now he's the head of the museum of the research there.
Well, you have a number of these people. We talked a lot with people about what were their histories. People don't usually wake up one day and say, I want to be a bomb maker. I want to be a nuclear weapons designer. And so it was intriguing.
I think there are a few people that might. Yes.
And at Los Alamos Laboratory, you have some nuclear weapons designers who play up, the Dr. Strange. I mean,
right.
They sort of play these characters. In the case you're talking about, we interviewed the head of nuclear weapons at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, who was maybe not so much a hippie, but he talked about his evolution from being sort of, I think he called himself moderately anti-nuclear. You know, there was a huge anti-nuclear movement in the 1980s, and actually in many parts during the Cold War. And he, you know, was sort of convinced by it. And it was slowly but slowly that he, you know, worked at a nuclear weapons laboratory, bought into the logic of deterrence and sort of converted into what he is today, which is the head of the nuclear weapons program. And so following that logic and then asking these people, well, where do you see your role today? And you get a lot of confusion.
How many of these places that you went to are off limits to the public? After all, you're a writer, a well-known journalist, and you write about nuclear weaponry. Can we all get in to see the same stuff that you did?
The majority of the places, particularly in the United States, in fact, I would almost say, I think all of them with one exception, they have some form of public tours. We went in parts that were public. We used our status as journalists to request interviews that I think the public, of course, would have a harder time getting. But what's amazing is that a lot of these sites, there are public tours. The Nevada test site, where you still have not full nuclear tests, but subcritical tests. The Department of Energy has a once-a-month bus tour. You can see these massive craters where we, you know, tested nuclear weapons.
Aren't you afraid of glowing in the dark after visiting these sites a little bit?
You know, there was one, the site of Trinity, the first nuclear bomb, we'd asked that question, and they said, well, you know, we're the government. We wouldn't let you in here if it was day. Kind of
then I'm not going there for sure with that issue.
Yeah, I mean, in most places, yes. I mean, what they say is that the radiation is at background levels. It's safe. There are parts of the Nevada test site that they won't let the public into. They didn't let us into for safety concerns. But, you know, we take them at their word and take it on the fact that probably for a one-day visit, it's not going to harm us.
You even talk about visiting Iran. I mean, it seems like our own people can't get in there.
Well, you know, it was kind of intriguing because what we wanted to do with the book is visit an example of different things rather than everything in the nuclear world. So we wanted to visit a country that was involved in sort of proliferation, non-proliferation debates. And while we were writing the book or in the process of it, President Ahmadinejad came forward and said, you know, we want to prove that Iran has only peaceful nuclear intentions. So we invite tourists, American journalists, whomever, to visit Iran sites. And we thought, well, we're writing a book on nuclear tourism. So we put in our applications. It took a while, but we eventually were given, I think, about 5 days' notice that we would be invited on a tour of the Isfahan uranium conversion facility in Iran.
And did you go?
We went, and it was, you know, it was certainly probably up there with one of the more interesting trips that we made. In some ways, we saw a lot. We had a number of interviews with parliamentary government officials, nuclear scientists in Tehran. We were given a full tour of Isfahan, of their uranium conversion facility. But the caveat being that at the time we visited in February 2007, the focus of diplomatic back and forth and concerns about Iran's nuclear program wasn't Isfahan, the city we went to, or the plant there. It was Natanz, where they were building centrifuges. So, you know, we were there and we said, well, what about Natanz? This is the focus of things. And they said, ah, it'll come in a day or two. Yes, you'll be allowed in. Well, it's a year and a half later. And to our knowledge, no tourists or journalists have been allowed into Natanz. So, you know, there were some interesting and good and transparent things about the trips, but there were some problems as well.
I'll bet. 1-800-989-8255. Nathan in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up the Hanford facility in southeast Washington State. I just read an article in the Oregonian newspaper, actually. I think close to 100,000 people go tour that every year. And it's where they made the plutonium for the bomb, the Trinity bomb.
Sharon?
Yes. And in fact, you know, we get the most question most often, why not Hanford? I mean, apparently it is just it is overbooked. The Department of Energy can't accommodate all of the people who want to visit there. And so I highly recommend it. The reason why we didn't go there is we wanted to go, when we had a choice, we wanted to go to places that were still actively a part of the nuclear complex. Hanford is basically a cleanup site. And so instead of Hanford, we decided to go to Y-12 in Tennessee, where basically it's, you know, the center of uranium. It's where they're doing a lot of dismantlement for nuclear weapons. If we produce new nuclear weapons, it'll be involved there. So we chose that over Hanford, but I would highly recommend Hanford as well. Apparently, it's just it is a very popular tour, as the gentleman pointed out.
Now, some of the places that you saw were basically relics of the Cold War, and others were actively in use today. If you go there, can you tell the difference between the two?
Well, that's one of the strange things. You know, one of the more interesting trips for us was we went to visit missileers, basically the Air Force officers that are about 65 feet underground and waiting to turn the key at the notice, you know, if they get the president's orders. And, you know, you go and you see where these two people are sitting underground in their shifts, and you go to the silos. And what's amazing is that the National Park Service, one state over, runs tours of decommissioned missile alert facilities and decommissioned areas. And it looks exactly the same as the one we're visiting that's still active today, which tells you something that, you know, in 20 years, not a lot has changed, but the world has changed a lot. And so you begin to ask yourself, why hasn't it changed? Why do we still have these missileers underground?
So we're still on very high alert that we don't talk about very much.
Yeah, I think one of the more disturbing things for us was, I mean, we're still on hair trigger alert. And I think that if you ask your average American, I don't even know that we at the very, very beginning quite realize that we're still on a hair trigger alert, that basically with orders in 30 minutes or less, there could be a missile from Russia to the United States or vice versa. And there was talk in the 1990s of bringing down that hair trigger alert, and it just didn't go anywhere. And I think that's one of the more unfortunate aspects, and one of the things that was really brought home to us that something about our nuclear posture really isn't quite right.
But we're not making any new nuclear weapons anymore, are we?
No. In fact, it's been well over a decade since we have. One of the political debates that went on over the past number of years was over something called a reliable replacement warhead. And they try very hard to say this is not a new warhead. It's a replacement warhead. Mm-hmm. This would be the first time since the end of the Cold War that we would be in the business of producing new nuclear weapons. And I think it's a bit disturbing that there wasn't a whole lot of public debate about it. As of right now, it's I don't want to say it's dead, but Congress took away the funding for it. But it's one of these things that comes back up every year. And I expect you'll see another proposal, you know, next year to sort of, you know, use some funding for this new nuclear weapon or replacement, whatever one wants to call it.
Is there a place you want to get to still that you couldn't get to? Besides the place in Iran?
I think we were very disappointed and disturbed by Russia, where we went, where we were not allowed. They still operate their nuclear cities as closed cities, just like Los Alamos was once a closed city. I believe it opened up in the 1950s. They still, you know, Russia still has these gates around their nuclear cities. And we were able to interview nuclear weapons scientists outside of the cities. And to the best of my knowledge, American journalists haven't been let in for a number of years. And I think that's both. I mean, it would have been nice to see them, what it's like, these closed cities. Yeah. But also it's disturbing from a transparency point.
We're talking with Sharon Weinberger, author of A Nuclear Family Vacation. We're going to take a break and come back with your questions. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about atomic tourism. If you want to take a nuclear family vacation, then you can buy a book of the same name written by Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger. And Sharon Weinberger is here. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in. Let's go to Roger in Salt Lake City. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Great. I had a question for the author, which was, I live in Utah, and we have a history of, we live downwind of the Nevada test site, and basically there's a lot of after effects that we felt from those tests in the 1950s, and I was wondering if they touch on that at all in their research.
Sure.
We don't focus on what are called the downwinders per se, but one of the issues that we try to bring up is how there was really kind of a shameful record during the Cold War of the U.S. and nuclear testing, both within the United States and also particularly in the Marshall Islands, one of the places we visited. What we focus on in the book is, I think, one of the disturbing aspects of the museums, the nuclear weapons and atomic museums you have around the United States. And they're very, very good museums. They're focused on children, on science education, nuclear education. I would say the one criticism I have of them is that they downplay some of the effects of radiation, and particularly Cold War nuclear testing. And what some of the people I spoke with in the nuclear world said was, oh, well, you know, a lot of these effects were overplayed, you know, questions about illness, and they were, and there's a lot of debate. There's a very active debate, and one can argue about it, but I still feel the museums need to play a role in both educating people about radiation, but also acknowledging some of the ill effects that it had during the era of nuclear testing. And I think without that balance, you really lose something. Mm.
Let's talk about a couple of those sites. Let's stick to Nevada. There's the Nevada test site is open to tourism, right?
Yes. Last time I checked, Department of Energy offers, I believe it's once a month tours. You know, my aunt, who is retired in Las Vegas, has gone on it. It's very popular with tourists. You have to reserve ahead of time, but it's interesting. It's free. We recommend it. And you get a sense of the history of the test site. I mean, you can kind of follow, you can see these, you know, the civil defense tests, you know, blown out houses with no glass that they built to test the effects on. And it's a fascinating tour.
Mm-hmm. And also Trinity is open, the White Sands Missile Range.
Yes, they open it. It's still an active site run by the Army. And so they open it up. They have two public days a year that are here are quite popular. They're also very accommodating to, you know, documentary filmmaker news people, but definitely two public days a year. They had a big 50th anniversary. And it's also interesting purely from a mm-hmm. historical perspective to mm-hmm. visit.
Phil in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just mention a fabulous site just south of Tucson. It's called the Titan Missile Museum. It's a decommissioned missile museum. The tour takes about 45 minutes. As a child of the 60s, I remember duck and cover, so I have a pretty good memory of these. But my daughter, who was 15, after sitting through the tour where they take one of the members of the tour, they sit them in the chair, the incoming message comes in and you launch it, no drama whatsoever, but just the working through it and seeing it, and they describe how the silo was supposed to do its job, and then they would wait for 30 days, and they could decide to come up or not. I mean, it's a wonderful tour.
Yeah, I've heard just wonderful things about that museum. We visited an active site, so we skipped the museum. But again, the National Park Service also offers a tour of a decommissioned, I believe it's a Minuteman II. There's the Titan Museum. One of the things we want to emphasize in the book is that these historical tours are wonderful, but it's important for people to realize that we no longer have Titans in the inventory, but we still have the Minuteman III. And so 30 minutes or less, you know, it's still, this sort of still looms over us. And I think it's important for people to remember that.
Brian in Elizabethtown, PA. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Yeah, you guys might have heard of Elizabethtown, but you probably heard of our next door neighbor, Middletown in Three Mile Island. I live actually right near the plant. And I was wondering, they actually, around 9/11, shut down. They had a little visitor center and a museum. And it used to be great to take our friends there when they were visiting from out of town. But now that's kind of shut down. Did you encounter that much around any of the other places? And I guess I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yes, we did. In some cases, for instance, I believe Albuquerque, the Atomic Museum there, I believe it used to be on Kirtland Air Force Base, and they had to move it off base after 9/11 because there were too many problems with people. People basically couldn't get into the base. And so you see examples of that at a number of sites. In most places, they've made an earnest attempt to accommodate it. And, you know, but you're exactly right. That is a problem mm-hmm. after 9/11.
You devote a whole chapter to bunkers.
Yes, yes.
You must love bunkers. They must be fascinating.
We wanted to make sure, I mean, this is not just about nuclear weapons. It's how it affects the geography of the country. It's how it affects decision making. And so an integral part of nuclear weapons history are the shelters, the bunkers we built to protect our leaders and sometimes our money and other things from nuclear weapons from the other side. So there's some that you can visit. There's the decommissioned congressional bunker at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia, which is just, you know, it lives up to every sort of Hollywood image of, you know, secret doors and passageways and all that.
Right.
And we also focus on, because one thing that 9/11 has also done, it has given sort of a new life to what are called continuity of government operations, these sort of Cold War era plans for what would we do with our leadership before attacked. And so some of the places that were about to be closed down, for instance, Site R, which is sometimes called the Underground Pentagon in Pennsylvania, were suddenly finding themselves with this new lease on life, which was interesting for our bunker chapter, but in a way, I think it should be disturbing for the public that you have this continuation of secret activities.
You know, one of the great hallmarks of the 50s, as I remember, were fallout shelters. I remember actually getting a government-issued pamphlet that showed me how to build three different kinds of fallout shelters with blueprints and diagrams and things like that if I wanted to. Did you find any fallout shelters? You know, this is what people did in the 50s sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, you can still see them driving across the United States. You know, we focused on the big bunkers. But what's interesting about that is these things always find a new life. You know, people who did civil defense planning during one point in the Cold War, you know, it turned into tornado drills for those of us from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Bunkers that had a life during the Cold War are now sort of, you know, anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism.
Right.
There's one proposal out of Huntsville to turn a cave into sort of a civil defense shelter.
Hmm. Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The author answered my question already about the Greenbrier, and I was going to ask if there was a tour of that facility up there that they had built for the Congress in case of a nuclear event.
Is there a tour?
Yes, the hotel, the resort, they have the bunker open for tours. It's on their website, and it's really wonderful. I mean, the hotel cherishes the history there, and it's, you know, it's one of those places. You know, there's some places you go to, it's like, it's so. The Greenbrier is really well worth the visit for the bunker tour.
1-800-989-8255. We have room for just a couple of more calls. Moshe in Tucson.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am from Natanz, Iran. And I would like to respectfully take issue with your author's assertion that there hasn't been visits to Natanz. There actually have been many visits to Natanz, even by reporters and by some selected tourists. Sorry that she was.
Have you been there yourself?
I've been near it.
So how do you know that there have been visits?
There have been reports. International reports. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has been in, they have people 24 hours, 7 day a week in Natanz, along with their cameras, along with their soil samples, along with their aerial samples.
But we're talking about tourism here. How many tourists get to visit it?
The place is under Israeli and American nuclear weapons threat. And you want it to be open for tourists?
Have some
perspective. Right now, the U.S. and Israel are threatening Natanz, specifically my hometown, with their nuclear weapons.
Hang on, Moshe. We're talking about tourism here. Sharon?
I know, but you're asking for tourism in a place that is super, super, super sensitive.
But, Moshe, we could argue the whole world is targeted by in some way by everybody.
No, it's not.
Sharon, do you want to answer that?
I think the gentleman brings up two good points. The first about the IAEA inspectors. But, again, what we were talking about, and I can only speak from my own experience, what I've seen, they released a number of photos. New York Times did a wonderful spread on the photos of Natanz about an official visit. I can speak to the journalists when we were there requesting again and again. And again, it wasn't our request. The basis of our visit was President Ahmadinejad promising people that all the nuclear sites, that there would be transparency and openness. So I'm not saying that every single place should be open. I'm saying what was promised versus what we got. As for the nuclear threat issue, one of the things that was driven home to us in Isfahan, we were taken for a tour of the city. It's a beautiful city, cultural, historical tour, and said, well, you know, look at the city that will be destroyed if there are airstrikes here. So they were, in terms of the airstrikes, they wanted us to see a city because they wanted Western journalists to see the devastation that would come if there were airstrikes. You know, whether a country should or should not open up all its nuclear sites, yes, there's going to be debates about that. I can only speak about what was promised versus what we saw. I understand the gentleman's concerns.
Yeah. You know, we could get into a whole other discussion, which I don't want to get into. But I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. This is a very interesting read. If you're looking for a different kind of vacation or you just want to learn about the nuclear weapons industry and what's going on today, it's a nuclear family vacation, travels in the world of atomic weaponry. Written by Nathan Hodge and our guest who's with us here in the studio, Sharon Weinberger. Thank you for taking time on this holiday to come and visit us, Sharon.
Thanks for having me.
Happy 4th. Good luck to you. Happy 4th to you. For the rest of the hour, helping to plan out the rest of your summer vacation. Maybe you don't want to go to a nuclear site and you want something else. You know, there are tours for people who like fine wine or cheeses, old houses. But what if you're into science and technology? What destinations should be on your itinerary? And I'm asking you to help out now. If you've got a hidden gem near you that you want to recommend or something that you've seen, a place that you've visited, it's a big country, it's a big world that you think that no science buff should miss, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Or email your suggestions to travel@sciencefriday.com. That's travel@sciencefriday.com. We'll post your highlights from your suggestions on our website after the program. Joining me now to help navigate through all the country that it has to offer to us in a highly qualified tour guide is Patricia Schultz. She's the author of the books 1,000 Places to See in the U.S. and Canada Before You Die, and the earlier 1,000 Places to See Before You Die, both published by Workman. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Big book. What percentage would you say would be interested to science science-minded people in a thousand places.
Well, I like to think that science-minded folks are interested in far more than just the immediately obvious, but specifically so, 15-20%. You know, it's always so hard to create a number. Yeah.
There are a lot of – let's begin with you know, places we can all get to. There are a lot of caves, for example, things like that that you can – oh, they're scattered all around the country.
Well, you know, certainly the most visited and the most known are Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, which are a magnificent mammoth cave known to many Corvette lovers as the place down the street. One of my all-time favorites, and I went to school in Washington, so within the Shenandoah Valley, which in itself is a designation that is a must-see because it's just so naturally beautiful, are the Luray Caverns.
Right, they are pretty.
Yeah, limestone caverns, one of many, many in this network underneath the Shenandoah Valley, and one of the most visited in the East for two things in particular, I think. And one is the stalactite organ,
right.
Said to be the largest musical instrument. It holds its own Guinness Book of Records designation. And it's played on these stalactites, each of which emanates its own sound, really magnificent when played by the appropriate music meister. And also the Dream Lake, which is airy, mystical, beautiful, 6 inches deep, and the only thing of its kind.
I have one to add to make it 1,001. It's not in your book. That's one of my favorites. And it's the Howe Caverns, which is right next to Cooperstown. So if you're visiting my favorite, one of my favorite things to do is visit baseball parks and places. If you're visiting Cooperstown for the baseball, you can go right next door into Howe Caverns. It's beautiful.
That's wonderful. And, you know, in the summertime, the Glimmerglass Opera, so you can do a little opera at night, a little caverning in the morning.
Well, we're talking about places to visit this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, here with Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's get a suggestion from a listener. Holly in Kansas City, Mo. Hi, Holly.
Hello.
Hi there.
I wanted to mention some. We like the U.S. government facilities. My family's always on the lookout for factory tours when we visit cities. And some of the U.S. government facilities that we have seen recently that have been very educational have really held my children's interest. There is an atmospheric center that overlooks Boulder, Colorado. You often hear releases from that center. It has beautiful scenery and trails. Plus, you learn a lot about the atmosphere and air, and they have exhibits. Woods Hole Oceanographic, which is on the other side of the country, on the Atlantic Ocean, again, is free, tremendous information about oceanography and atmosphere. We love military bases, like we've taken the Norfolk tour for the, you see large aircraft carriers and all kinds of Navy facilities there. Mm-hmm. Dayton is Air Force, Hill Air Force Base. When we were talking last half hour about the nuclear facility, their place up in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is an air base that you can see a museum about nuclear facilities.
Wow! Don't overburden us, Holly.
You'll have to write your own book, my sequel.
Well, no, I'm anxious to see your book because when we go to cities, we always look for that kind of thing, either free or cheap and educational.
Maybe
West Virginia coal mine was another one we really enjoyed, and seeing the copper mine in Salt Lake City, Utah.
All right, thanks, Holly. And she's been around, it looks like.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite or a top five that you might recommend, top three?
You know, factory tours are very fascinating. And I think I slept through much of my American history classes because and it awakens the inner child in me. I think it really brings you back to when you're 12 years old. And, you know, the kids enjoy it as much as the family. I went in Detroit. You can't really visit any of the automobile factories except for one, and it is nothing less than fascinating. And it's the Ford Rouge factory, and it's named after the nearby river, the Rouge River. I always wondered just where the name came from. It's the only one you can visit in Detroit. You can visit the homes of the great, you know, iconic families. And there's a Chrysler Museum, which is also very interesting. But the factory itself is magnificent, and it takes you along the assembly line. It was built in 1917 when 100,000 workers manned the assembly line, and the goods would come in at one end of the factory, and the cars would kind of roll out the other end. And it takes you through the history. It has films. You go with a guide. It just brings alive that entire chapter in history. I think that's fascinating. I mentioned very briefly before the Corvette factory, only half jokingly, because people take it very Seriously. And there is an assembly plant
outside. Is there a Harley factory, too?
Yeah. I don't. Do you know where it is?
Someone will let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a break, but we're going to come back and talk lots more with Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada. And gosh, if you can only get to see two of them, you've got a long ways to go. Two of them a year. You got your job cut out for you. So stay with us. We'll come back and take your suggestions. I'll tell you why I love the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. So we'll come back. It's a good place, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back and talk about that. It's some place you can walk to down the block if you walk in L.A. at all anymore. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about traveling, travel tips for science destinations, nature, things like that, factories that have interesting things. I remember visiting the Hershey factory.
They
don't do that.
No.
I think people were getting ill from the smell. It's such an overwhelming chocolate smell that they don't
do
that.
Yeah, I know. And also following September 11th, quite a number of the factories across America shut down or cut back or closed entirely. The Corning Museum, for example, in upstate New York, they now manufacture most of their glass and their Steuben glass division, I think, as well in West Virginia, which has an old history of glass making as well. But it's true. Yeah, I have fond memories of Hershey.
I have fond memories of Corning. That's the voice of Patricia Schultz, the author of 1,000 Places to See in the USA and Canada Before You Die. And we're taking your suggestions. Of course, our listeners came to our rescue. We asked about the Harley-Davidson Museum, Milwaukee.
I think, isn't there also something in Pennsylvania?
Could be. I don't know. We'll look.
Milwaukee, we
were in Milwaukee a few weeks ago doing a show on beer. And that a beer place. That's an interesting
brewery,
right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the oldest in America is the Yuengling in Pottsville, not too far from Philadelphia. Still family owned. There's a Yuengling usually on site, keeping it real, talking to the folks visiting. In the old 1800s structure with a beautiful stained glass window from the late 1800s. Mm. And you follow it from beginning to end, and there's that sampling room at the end of it all.
Of course. There has to be. Ken in Greenville, California. Hi.
Oh, there.
Hi there.
My destination I want to recommend is Lava Beds National Monument, which is up in the northeastern corner of California near the Klamath Basin. It's a fascinating geological volcanic site and has a great history story around Native American wars. It was the site of the last Indian war in the United States, the Modoc Indian War. And it's the park consists of a series of lava caves were formed by lava tubes from lava flowing at some distant past time. And there's hundreds of miles of lava caves, and you're just free to go out there and explore. You're in the high desert. It's really a fascinating place.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
All right, and our Pennsylvania callers are calling in saying it's Yuengling.
That's
how it's pronounced. You can't.
I guess
they keep us honest.
I tippled too much.
No, listen, I am not one to correct anybody else's pronunciation of any. I can't get two sentences out without making a mistake about a name. And I did mention before the break that one of my favorite places, and it's in your book, is the La Brea Tar Pits, right there in the middle of L.A.
In the middle, I know. And unless you live, as an East Coaster, I was kind of brought there by a local friend who said, "You're not going to believe this." And I didn't know where to put it in the book, so I included it as a kind of postscript to this entry about the museums of L.A., because it is very much a museum, but of an entirely curious, different nature. And it's 40,000 years old, this kind of bubbling pit, excavations that are still going on today.
Right.
And they say there are some 400 species of mammals, birds, fish, many of which are now extinct, that they have found there. It's really nothing short of fascinating, especially when you understand in the context, as you said, of downtown.
Yeah.
As if you were to find it like, I don't know, Central Park.
Yeah, even a more rural setting than that, a more urban setting than that. You're just walking down and there it is. Right in the
bubbling.
Middle of traffic.
Bubbling.
I think the first time I saw it was on a Walt Disney show in the 50s. I think they're looking around for something besides Disneyland to show. So they had the La Brea Tar Pits. Another interesting spot that I've been to that I would recommend in your book is the very large array, all these radio telescopes. That can you get to see that, or is that off limits?
I don't know. It's been quite some time since I was there, but it has long held my. We'll have to put that out to your listeners as well, and if in fact it's still open, because as I said, after September 11th, so many things of even remotely sensitive nature have no longer been made.
And that was made famous, I guess, by Jodie Foster in Contact. She was working the very large array. It'd be interesting to see how much of that is open. 1-800-989-8255. There are all kinds of places and things to see. Let's go just down the phone line and work our way down. Tony in Nevada City, California. Hi, Tony.
Hi, I love your show, and when I miss it, I get the podcast.
Thank you.
I have two science destinations for you. One is the Stennis Center on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where you can actually walk under the engine bells from Saturn V's, and you really get an idea of what rocket science is. And there's a 100,000 horsepower pump that will fit in the front seat of your car. And the other one is there's a B&B, an astronomical B&B in Arizona, where you can go and spend the night, and you can rent a University of McDonald's astronomer for the evening.
You know, there are three of these rockets, these Saturn rockets still around. There was supposed to be three more missions to the moon that were canceled, and they're all lying on the ground. They look so sad.
Oh.
If you've seen them, you know, they look so, he's thinking this could have gone to the moon, and it didn't, and they used to be in pretty bad shape. They've been upgraded a little better now, and they're not nesting places so much for the birds as they used to be.
Thanks for the great show.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Any NASA site, you know, if you just want to go to Orlando and see NASA there.
Yeah, well, you know, not just.
It's a great destination.
And it is a shame that, you know, I was just in London a few weeks ago. My friend said, you know, we Brits think America is all about New York, San Francisco, and Orlando. And I said, well, have you heard about the Kennedy Space Center? And she said, no, just Orlando. It's all about Disney. And it's only 50 miles.
Yeah.
You actually could do it in an afternoon. There are no launches scheduled, I think, during the summer months. But there's something for September. To see a launch in person, I think, is something you've got to do once in your life before you die.
And you can just be 50 miles away and still see the launch.
Oh,
you don't have to be right up close.
I can't remember
how many I've seen, but, you know, mm-hmm. you can be just close by. And if you get to see a night launch, that is spectacular.
Yeah. Well, there's also one of my favorite elements to a visit to the Kennedy Space Center was the Hall of Fame. And there was going on a lunch with an astronaut that afternoon. And there were never so many fascinated 12-year-olds that you could see in one spot. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Jill in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Hi, Jill.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Fine.
I was just calling to call about Arecibo in Puerto Rico.
Ah.
Where the movie Contact had a big portion of it filmed there. We had gone there last summer on vacation, and it was just a crazy way to get up to the observatory. But it's this. I'm sure maybe you both know about it a little bit better than I do. But
it's a giant radio telescope.
Yeah, the ionosphere, right?
Yeah.
The ionosphere center, in just this amazing, gigantic telescope that picks up radio waves. And you really couldn't get down to the actual piece of it, but
yeah, it's very big.
The view of it was just amazing. Like the photos of it that we took just give it no perspective at all. Being there is actually what you need to do to see it, and it's in the middle of nowhere in Puerto Rico.
Well, that's a good tip because we wouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Thank
and have
you.
A happy Fourth.
Bye bye.
Bye. Yeah, there are a lot of these radio telescope places.
Mm-hmm.
There's the biggest, I guess, that would be in Hawaii. You
know, yeah.
Go to Hawaii to see the lava, right?
Yeah, go to Hawaii, period.
Yeah. Well, let's go.
Well, it's celebrating its 50th anniversary
next year. I'm ashamed to say I've never been to Hawaii.
Year would be the time to go. There's so much going on, a lot celebrating the history of it, and magnificent.
Let's move over a piece to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Hi, welcome, Allison.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi there.
Well, I never knew I was a science buff till I started going to national parks in Canada and the United States, and just found myself fascinated by the age of our Earth and evolution and the entirely beautiful geological formations that you can find everywhere. And most recently I went to the Atlantic provinces, to Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, and there I saw some creatures that had lived from the very beginnings of when the Earth started supporting life called strombolites.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of them?
Sure, sure.
And they're in the northwestern part of Newfoundland on the Upper Peninsula, and then also by the Bay of Fundy where people go to watch the big tide changes.
Right.
There are some amazing finds there of like where the first reptile came about, and you know, lots of firsts. Gros Morne National Park, also in Newfoundland, has the Earth's innards that
right.
have been
right.
thrown up that you can only see usually at the bottom of the ocean. And also, they have a place right on the coast there in Gros Morne that you can take tours and guided tours and all, where they actually have the scientifically approved site of where two different epochs separate, you know, in geological
right.
epochs. So
that's great.
It sounds very nerdy, and it is. But when you're doing it, it's just so fascinating. You feel like you're part of something just really ancient.
You know, and the great part about if you drive a little bit, it's getting a little more difficult to drive, is
right.
there are unexpected pleasures that you discover. And I can think of one in particular. I remember the first time I drove through Colorado around Denver and the Boulder area. The highway would cut right through the road, and there was an exhibition right there in the road cut.
Right, exactly.
Of the history of the area, you know?
And in the Bay of Fundy, where you're doing the tides, that's where they find, you used to find amethyst on the beach and all that. And I just thought those were things that were in special caves, but they're actually in the earth.
Yeah.
At any specific place where, you know, the pressure was enough, the chemicals were right, that these gems were created. So it doesn't have to be in a gemological.
Yeah, I'll take it.
A dually site, you know.
There you go. You know, and I remember John McPhee wrote a whole book about rocks and driving across the country and just looking at the rocks.
Yeah. My God, that's a soulmate of mine, I'll tell you. But it is just, you know, all about the people, too. These people are so passionate. And what was ironic was after watching the fossils of these really creatures from the beginning of time, I turned on the radio in Canada, and there was a program about how they didn't believe in evolution or any of it, and said that everything was not more than 6,000 years old, and I just couldn't believe it, because I had just come from a place where things of a million years age were very evident, you know.
Yep.
So I think it's important for people to...
The objects speak for themselves.
Yes, they do.
Thank you, Viv.
Thank you.
And happy travels. I feel like I'm doing a travel show now.
But
thank
you,
Allison.
Are.
Yes, I am. And I'm sitting here with a great traveler, Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada. You could not have gone to all these places.
No, but it's funny that that gal had brought up Newfoundland, because it's one of those really bizarre, off-the-grid kind of places you would never consider until somebody drags you along and you stand there with your mouth up, so fascinated by the physical beauty and the human history as well, because in that area of the Maritimes, they have a lot of sites who are said to be the first Viking presence in North America. The natural beauty, the wine regions, the Scottish and English history of hundreds of years ago, the music and the festivals that are still alive, mm-hmm. you know, keeping that heritage alive every summer. So who'd have thunk it? Newfoundland, Labrador, Nova Scotia, and, mm-hmm. you know, our wonderful neighbor to the north, Canada, that you just don't consider much.
Yeah.
It's very underrated.
No, I think they kind of like it.
They
like
so.
Some tourism, because I see the ads.
Not too much.
We're talking with Patricia, I told you to screw up somebody's name. Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, taking your phone calls. Let's see how many more we can get in. Audrey in Fort Myers. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you guys today? Happy 4th.
You too.
I just wondered if Patricia had anything in her book about the Southwest Florida region. Of course, I'm biased because I live here, but there's the Thomas Edison and Ford Estate, as well as the beaches and the Coruscant State Park. There's just a lot of wonderful family places to visit, as well as scientific places to research. And
And lots of swamps to look at.
That's right.
I just read also that the Florida government had approved of the purchase of some massive piece of land that was to be...
Sugar planted.
Yeah, brought back to its original state and added on as a postscript to the Everglades, which I think is just fascinating and again, underrated. I think you need to go with a guide because otherwise it's just a big sea of grass who will kind of bring alive, you know, the habitat, what you're not seeing, as well as what you're seeing. One of our more interesting national parks, and there are hundreds, what the one of your listeners was saying before, our national park system alone is magnificent. I don't think any other country in the world has preserved and recognized and acknowledged our the wealth of natural beauty that we have.
Audrey, would you want to wait till maybe the winter time to come to Florida with the...
The winter is actually the busy season. If you come in the summer, you avoid, you know, a lot of crowds. But it's nice all year round, which is why I live here.
Well, thank you for calling, and have a happy Fourth.
Thanks. You too.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada. Can there be a part of the world you're going to write about next that's not the USA and Canada, Patricia? Or are you
I'd like to.
With this?
Oh, I'm happy. I mean, everything fascinates me, and there's such a wealth everywhere you look. I think Europe, a lot of the peripheral areas of Europe where the dollar still says something, such as the Baltic states or the Balkan countries, the former Yugoslavia, Croatia was just there, Slovenia, magnificent, beautiful. So I'd like to, I think, concentrate my attentions there. But I'll go anywhere. Why? Were you thinking of something
in
particular?
I'd love to go to all of those. You know, and there's a lot of history of science in a lot of these places.
Everywhere. You know, I know. You don't need to look
Nikola Tesla just jumps into my mind. You have to look him up when you go to Croatia.
We were at his home. Thank you, Ira. We were there.
You're way
fascinating
ahead of me.
Guy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was responsible for a lot of what we have today and gets very little credit and not enough credit for it.
And Tesla, in Croatia, gets a lot.
Does.
I believe he's on the local currency and
exactly.
every imaginable stamp.
Exactly. And it's hard to choose. You know, you look at your book at 1,000 places, it's hard to choose. I guess the best way to work it is to pick out a geographical area that you want to
visit. It can be. We really tried to make it as user-friendly as possible because of the volume, the possibilities. So let's say you're interested in the Southwest or the Northeast or the Maritime provinces in Canada. You can use the book in that way, or there are many, many, many indexes at the back of the book. Maybe it's just about coastal areas or beaches, or maybe it's just about museums. Maybe it's about natural history of the parks. So that way you can utilize the book as well, because there's so much information. It's really just, I hope people find it jam-packed with possibilities.
It is. And boy, it's heavy. It's a big book.
Yeah.
I
was busy.
I'll bet you were. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today on the holiday season. There's Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the USA and Canada. That's about all the time we have for today. We've run out of time. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Maleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, or you can send us mail the classic way. That's Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. And we're podcasting and blogging on sciencefriday.com. You can download our podcasts on iTunes, both video. We have a lot of video podcasts. You can get them on your iPod or just watch them on your laptop. Have a great and safe holiday weekend, 4th of July. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.